We are once again in the book of Ecclesiastes. If you have a Bible with you, I would invite you to open to that book. We will be looking at a number of passages, a number of scriptures from that particular book of the Bible. Remember back to our first message, we put a title to this series, Things You Need to Hear, Lessons on Life from the Book of Ecclesiastes. And that is where we are today. Last week was an introduction, kind of an overview, if you will, of the book. Today we'll dive into the first section. We've divided the book into four sections. We will look at the first section today. We will look at that first lesson on life from the book of Ecclesiastes in this particular message. And I would begin with another introduction to this particular message. And it's just a hearkening back, if you will, to some of the things that were stated last week. We are on a search for meaning and purpose in life. That is the quest that we are on in this series. And the biblical book of Ecclesiastes is our source. We know that we live in a culture that devalues human existence. All you need to do is listen to those who are in scientific circles, read some of the scientific textbooks, watch a few shows from the Discovery Channel or from public television having to do with mankind, who he is and where he came from. And you'll find out rather quickly that human existence is nothing more than or we are, as human beings, nothing more than more highly evolved animals. All of our activities, it would seem, all of our choices that we make, all of our behavior is nothing more than what comes naturally to us as more highly evolved animals. And so when you observe people in society doing certain things, when you find yourself making moral judgments, you need to remember that the world doesn't think that way, that morality necessarily has anything to do with our actions or our behavior, but people are just doing what comes to them naturally as a more highly evolved race of animals, if you will. Sure, there are consequences of our actions, but they're pretty much limited to the span of our lives. Long term, to many people in our society, when you talk about things being long term and long term consequences, well, they're only talking about the span of a man's life. And so consequences to your actions in the long term would only last for as long as you would live. And so the notion, or any notion of existence after this life, that's foolishness to you. To talk of such things as fairy tale stuff, to talk of the ramifications of what would happen to a man or a woman after they died, to talk about any kind of existence after this life, it's just foolishness. And certainly, any thoughts of judgment and any thoughts of consequences that would span eternity are the inventions of superstitious and uneducated minds, many would say. It's just so much gibberish. You're really not in the mainstream of society. You're not thinking like an educated person. You're more like the ancients of old, those superstitious tribes and peoples who have some silly notion of life after death. It's all just something you're dreaming after. And aren't you, after all, just trying to impose your morality upon other people, your superstitious religious systems? So to hear that kind of a philosophy day after day, and the children are subjected to that in classrooms, anyone who watches a scientific television program is subjected to that each and every time, for the most part. To be subjected with that philosophy and to have that philosophy in your mind and to teach that to others, if that's the way people are thinking, what is left? You know, what is left in life? What is there to this life? What are we left with if this is it? If there is nothing else other than just this so-called animal existence, This is all there is. And so if you are one of those, if your whole philosophy in life is that this is it, you know, I'm just going to go for whatever I can get in this lifetime because we know there's nothing else after this, you know, go for it. That's what you're being taught. Go for it. Perhaps you have that very philosophy. I'm only here for a short time. I don't know how long I'm going to live. I don't know how long I will be in this world, but I know that there's nothing else after this. Because that's what all the scientific shows tell me, and that's what all the so-called educated minds would tell me. There's nothing after this. So I might as well go for it while I'm here. I'll get what I can get. I'll enjoy what I can enjoy. And personal happiness becomes the goal. Isn't that what we're looking for in this society? People all over the world looking for personal happiness. What can I get today to make me happy? What can I enjoy? What can I get out of life today? You might as well go for whatever you can get in this life. If that's all there is, I mean, if they just bury you when you die and that's the end of existence, then go for it. And so money becomes the object. Why money? Because money is the key. Money is the key to many these days to personal happiness. Get yourself the best job, you're taught. If you get yourself the best job, you can get yourself more money. So do whatever you can do to get that best job. Doesn't make any difference who you have to step on. It doesn't make any difference, you know, what laws you have to bend or what kind of moral judgment you might have to suspend. Just do whatever you can do. Get that job. Get yourself through school. You know, even if you have to cheat a little bit to get yourself through a good school. Even if you have to cheat a little bit to get yourself into a good school. Just do whatever you got to do just to get that job. Once you get the best job, you want to advance in that job, of course, because you know the better off, well, the higher you are in the company, the better off you are, the more money you're going to make. And the more money you make, the more you can acquire, the more you can use that money for personal happiness. Because after all, you've seen the way the poor people live. You've seen on television, you know, the lousy living conditions, the terrible houses they live in, the terrible cars they drive, if they're able to drive at all. You know, where's the happiness in that? And so you think, if you're wrapped up in this whole philosophy, you think that money becomes the key. And so you do whatever you can to advance in the job. And we've even seen many do whatever they have to do not to work and still be able to get money. Because money is the key. It gets you the best and the biggest houses. It gets you the coolest cars. It gets you the finest, most fashionable clothing and jewelry and accessories. You eat of the finest foods that this life has to offer. And so you're in this vicious circle of getting money to obtain possessions, of obtaining all of the good things that this life has to offer. And possessions become a source of happiness for many. It's all predicated on you being happy. It's all designed in this philosophy for you to have personal happiness because there is nothing else. What else is there? There's no sense in living a poor life. Where's the sense in that? There's nothing to be gained by living in poverty, so let's go for what we can get. And then we find ourselves, or you might find yourself, gratifying the senses, looking for physical pleasure, just feeling good. Just trying to get whatever pleasure you can get out of life. And you got to fulfill your heart's desire. How many times have you heard that? Don't let anything stand in your way of your dreams. Whatever your heart desires, go for it. You can do it. Don't let anything get in the way, because you only go this way once. Are you wrapped up in that kind of a philosophy of getting what you can get in this life because you know you only go this way once? Don't let anything get in your way, they would tell you. An unwanted pregnancy doesn't have to be a problem. We have ways of dealing with that. You don't have to have that child that's going, after all, you know, you're not in a financial position to take care of a child. This child is just going to get in the way of your lifestyle, so we have ways of dealing with that. Don't let an unwanted pregnancy, quote unquote, stand in your way. So any ideas, obviously, of morality here and judgment or doing the right thing, it's just totally foreign, this whole mindset. And you who are married, got a spouse who's getting a little old, not quite looking like they used to. Remember when you were first married, when you were first courting? Boy, he or she was the greatest thing that ever came along, and boy, just looking longingly into each other's eyes, you remember all of that and all of those good things, and it was pretty nice. And now, some years have gone by, and perhaps the spouses, you know, not treating you as nicely as they did back in the beginning. Perhaps things aren't the way they were back in the very beginning, and they're starting to look a little old. They kind of let themselves go. How could they do that to you? You deserve better than that. And so, don't let that stand in your way. And I heard recently of a former CEO of a major corporation who was involved with an extramarital affair. You know, a scandal in many circumstances, in many circles, that would be a scandal. Cheating on his wife to have an affair with another woman, younger no doubt, and probably a little nicer looking. And I heard him saying, what are you blaming me for, basically, to paraphrase? I haven't done anything wrong. I haven't stolen anything. I haven't cheated anyone. I just fell in love. I just fell in love. So, if your spouse gets in the way of you falling in love with somebody else, there are ways of dealing with that. You get rid of them. Divorce. That is the philosophy underlying, you know, the way many people are living today. That's the way many people live. Don't let anything get in the way of your heart's desire. I was just thinking something in my mind that was kind of germane to this whole situation, but I'm not going to say it because it's too personal. But you understand what I'm saying. There are people, you may be one of them, who is just looking to get what they can get out of this life and to satisfy your own personal desires, to gratify the whole desire for pleasure, and let nothing get in your way. Because after all, if you don't take this opportunity when this nice young woman comes along or this strapping young man comes along who is so much better than your spouse, if you don't take advantage of this opportunity, you may never get another chance. And so don't cheat yourself out of this pleasure that you can gain. You know, television programming is often an indication of the way people are thinking. They're producing things that you want to see and or things that they think you want to see. And I couldn't help but thinking of some of these makeover shows. Not that there is anything necessarily wrong. There are a couple I'm thinking of in particular. One where your home can be made over. A radical makeover where they totally redo your home. I'm talking thousands of dollars being spent to redo your home. They'll send you away. And usually, this would involve a family who has experienced some difficult things in life. Children who are sick or who are paralyzed or whatever. For some reason, they can't have the home of their dreams. And so they'll come in, they'll send you away for a while, and they'll totally redo your home. So when you come home, it's the house of your dreams with all new appliances and a kitchen and everything just looks so beautiful. And there isn't anything inherently wrong with doing something for somebody like that. I'm not faulting that. But let me give you another example before I bring that to a conclusion. This whole idea of physical makeovers. There are other shows where you find that they will do a complete makeover of your body, where they will take you in and they will have specialists do your teeth over. They will have specialists take out all the extra fat. They'll lift this and tuck that and make things bigger, and you'll just look like a brand new person when you're all done. And even this, I don't think there's anything necessarily inherently wrong. I may have more of a problem with that. What really bothers me in things like this is the whole underlying philosophy that if we can just change your outward circumstances and change your outward appearance, then it will make everything okay. Everything will be better. Just by changing some outward appearances and changing things, it'll make you a brand new person. You know, to give you a home that is brand new, even though you couldn't afford something like that on your own, and you may not even keep it up afterwards, you deserve it because of the hardships that you've faced. And this whole underlying philosophy of making things okay and making things better, if we just change on the outside and change the way things look, And if you've ever seen what they've done to some of these people, it's almost miraculous. People who really are not very attractive and who have been born with some serious deformities and just don't look all that attractive. And they've often suffered mentally as a result of these things. And we'll talk about their anguish as a result of the way they look. And when they are done with them, it's an amazing transformation. You'd hardly even recognize them. They're so beautiful. But unfortunately, doing all that, as we know, doesn't do anything to change the inside. And so it's that underlying philosophy that bothers me, that a makeover will cure everything. So is that all there is?
I think those shows are kind of indicative,
you know, because people love to watch them. I have to admit, you know, I've watched some of them myself on occasion. We like to see the transformations that they can make in a home and in a person's body or whatever. It's kind of fascinating. But is that all there is? Simply going for a new look and to make yourself happy, to make yourself attractive, and just to go for those desires. Well, the writer of Ecclesiastes had a lot to say about these kinds of things. I know he wrote almost 1,000 years before Jesus Christ walked in the flesh on the earth. I know it was almost 3,000 years ago. And yet the things he said were very relevant to those very kinds of issues. And so there are four sections that we will be dividing this book into. And in the first one, we'll be covering portions of the book from chapter 1, the beginning, chapter 1, verse 1, on through chapter 2, verse 26. I would point out that I am indebted to Walter C. Kaiser, Jr. for pointing out this particular structure of the book. There are many people, as I've said, who are very pessimistic about this book and saying there is no structure to it, that there really is no main point. And yet Kaiser points out that there are many people who have been able to break this book down into some sort of structure and show that it is not just pessimism, but that it speaks to life and every man's experience in life. So I'm indebted to him and some of the things that he's had to say concerning the breakdown, the structure of this particular book. And as we begin, in the beginning, let's look at the first argument that Solomon would make. The writer of Ecclesiastes, the preacher as he is called, this man of wisdom, the very first lesson, and listen to this, because this is the point, the argument that is being argued throughout the rest of the message. It is this: as hard as you may try to find true happiness in this life, it is nothing but an exercise in futility, because true happiness, joy, and meaning in life come only as gifts from God. Solomon is basically going to be saying, you don't have the ability to enjoy the things of life, although you may think you do. It is not possible for you to gain any understanding, to gain any meaning, or to enjoy truly the things of life. It's not within your grasp. It is only a gift of God. Insofar as God bestows these things upon you, then you are able. But apart from that, apart from any knowledge and relationship with God, you don't have the capability. You don't have the ability to do that, to enjoy these things and to know these things. Solomon's argument comes from his personal experience. He is uniquely qualified as king in Israel. Nothing was denied him. Sonny had mentioned this morning in talking about Solomon. If he came to these conclusions, there is nobody on this earth that can come to any other conclusion. If you understand Solomon and his background, being king in Israel, enjoying anything that he set his heart upon, then what's left after him? What else can anybody else do to enjoy these things? There was nothing that he could look at that he could deny himself or would deny himself. There was nothing that he could think of in his heart that he would be unable to enjoy. And so things that he will discuss in coming to this particular conclusion, that you cannot, as hard as you may try to find happiness and meaning, as hard as you may try to find these things, it is an exercise in futility. Things that he will discuss in coming to this conclusion include this: the treadmill of human existence. He's going to discuss that, and we will this afternoon as well. The treadmill of human existence. He'll describe that. The futility of self-indulgence. He'll describe that as well. The futility of living wisely.
perhaps that one gets your interest.
He's telling us that living wisely is a futile effort. It's just meaningless. He says that. Also, the futility of human effort. All human effort is described. And finally, he will come to a conclusion. And it will be the argument that we have just set forth. So look at his assertion then that man is on a never-ending quest for meaning. A treadmill. I had mentioned earlier, a rat race, as we like to say in our society, in our culture. Kind of like a rat in a cage. You ever see those pet rats or pet mice when they put them in a cage, they have that little exercise wheel in there for them? And the little rat or little mouse or gerbil, whatever he is, just runs and runs and runs. And the wheel goes around and around and around, but he never gets anywhere. It's just a never-ending race. It's kind of like us on a treadmill, if you use a treadmill for exercise. It may be chalking up the miles on your treadmill, but when all is said and done, you're in the very same place in the end that you started. And you haven't accomplished anything as far as getting anywhere. Of course, we use a treadmill for the mere purpose of exercise, and it has accomplished that. But this whole existence, this whole human existence is like that. It's like being on a treadmill, Solomon says. And it's all an exercise in futility. It's useless. It has no meaning. And so he starts with his summary. He begins with who he is, the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem, in verse 1, and summarizes human existence after that in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? It's a pretty pessimistic way to start out. He talks about vanity or futility or emptiness. The word has many different meanings that are all lumped into one here. It's senselessness, meaninglessness, or having no meaning, or even a vapor, as it literally is used. He says all is meaningless or futile. But when he says all, he's not talking here about all creation. If you approach this book, and I can see why some people might be rather pessimistic, if you come to this book thinking that Solomon is saying everything that exists just has no meaning, you're wrong. It's not what he's talking about. When he says all, he's not talking about all of creation, but rather all of man's toil. All that a man will do day in and day out. All that a man will do to try and gain some kind of existence that's meaningful. Some kind of meaningful toil. All of that is futility. All of that is meaningless. As a man attempts to do these things on his own for himself, what's the use? What profit is there when he says that in verse 3, in this particular version that I am using, which may be new to some of you, the English Standard Version, he says, what does man gain by all the toil? That word gain is the word profit, perhaps it says in the version that you have. It is a financial term. It is a business term. When all is said and done, when we've gone through all of these transactions and everything is concluded, what do you have left? What remains? That's what we call profit in the financial world. That's what we call gain in the business world. It's what's left. That's what he's talking about here when he says, what's the use? What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? So he's not saying all that exists is futility, that it has no meaning. But rather, he's talking about the toil that man expends day in and day out to try to gain something out of his life, just to have some profit. It's reminiscent of the words of Jesus Christ, which you'll find in the New Testament, when he says, what does it profit a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? It's the same word, it's the same idea. What gain is there? Jesus would say later in the New Testament, if you owned everything there was in the world, what good is it when all is said and done if you lose your own soul in the end? One rather loose translation says, you spend your life working, laboring, and what do you have to show for it? What do you have to show for it? Rather pessimistic. Some of us perhaps have thought that way. You young people who are just starting out in life, you couldn't wait to get out of school. Getting out of school would be the greatest thing because now you can get out into the real world and be like everybody else, and you find yourself needing an automobile. Well, you need money to get an automobile, but you need to be able to to be able to afford it, you need to have a job, so you can't get to your job if you don't have the automobile, and that becomes kind of a vicious cycle. Then you find yourself with expenses as you go out on your own and you live in a home, you need more money to pay for just the necessities of life, and it starts to become toil, and you start to understand what people are talking about when they talk about a rat race. You get up in the morning, you do all the things you did the previous morning so you can get to work, so you can earn your paycheck, so you can pay all your bills. And maybe, if you happen to be on a good job and you're very wise in your spending, you'll have enough left over so you can go out and spend it on yourself and get some kind of enjoyment out of this life.
And it becomes a rat race. What's the use in all of that, is what Solomon is saying.
What profit is there in that? Nature is a fitting illustration of man's existence, and that's what Solomon uses here in the following verses. Now look at verse 4 where he says, "A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever."
Here's another thing to knock you down a little bit when he says, your life is transitory.
It's just here, and then it's gone. You're here very briefly. The earth witnesses the coming and going of generation after generation of human beings. You come and you go. You have your time of going through life and earning your pay and getting a little bit of enjoyment out of it, and then you're gone. It's over like that. A generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth remains forever.
The earth being a witness of the human experience, it sees all this, so to speak. But then he uses the things of earth and the things of creation to show that even there is this restlessness. And he's illustrating human existence by nature. He's using the things of nature to show what it's like to be a man. Look what he says. "The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises day after day." Do you ever think about your existence? I was just thinking today about my existence when I get up in the morning on a work day. How routine it is and how much it is the same. Get up in the morning at the same time. I go into the bathroom at the same time. I take my shower. I get out. I shave. Put on the deodorant. On go the clothes. It's the same every day. Out comes the toothbrush. Not before I take my medication, but after I take the medication, and then I do this. Everything is just down to a routine. And it's easy to see a kind of thing being set up here where it's a treadmill existence. The sun rises, the sun goes down, and hastens to the place where it rises. "The wind blows to the south," he says in verse 6, "and goes around to the north. Around and around goes the wind, and on its circuits the wind returns." You would think if anything was changing all the time, it would be the wind. And yet the winds have their patterns. They come generally from the same places. They go to the same places, and they come back again, day after day after day.
And hopefully you're starting to think, that's just what my life is like. I get up in the morning, and I do the same thing day after day.
I come home at night, I go to bed just to get up in the morning and do the same thing all over again. And I feel like I'm losing sometimes. I'm losing ground on the treadmill. I'm going backwards.
And then the streams come into play here in verse 7. "The rivers run to the sea, but the sea is not full. To the place where the streams flow, there they flow again."
Interesting language. You would think, with all of those streams continuously flowing into the oceans, that one day the oceans would fill up and it would be kind of like, okay, that's enough. The oceans are full, no more flowing of the streams. But it doesn't work that way. Streams flow into the ocean. The water evaporates from the ocean, comes over the land, rains down on the earth into the streams, and back they flow right into the ocean again. A continuous treadmill of activity, a ceaselessness of activity there, a non-ceasing activity. It just continues on a regular basis. The sun, the wind, and the streams illustrate man's ceaseless activity. And that's why Solomon is saying, well, what do we get out of this life? What good is all of that if we just keep doing these same things over and over again without end? In verse 8, he summarizes that particular state. He says, "All things are full of weariness. A man cannot utter it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing." It's never done. It's never over. There is never enough of our doing. There is never enough of our gaining. It is just a weariness. It's unspeakable weariness. And it's never satisfied. It is never completed. It just goes on and on and on, like a journey on a treadmill. You never arrive. You never get there. So we come to verse 9.
verses 9 through 11 conclude the matter here of human existence being like that of being on a treadmill or a rat in a cage, on that squeaky little wheel that goes round and round and round. We come and we go as a race. There's repetition of futility, verses 9 through 11. What has been is what will be. What has been done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun. Is there a thing of which it is said, see, this is new? It has been already in ages before us. There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of later things yet to be among those who come after.
Now you're going to say, oh, well, we invent things every day. People are inventing new things every day. But you know what? There's nothing new about that. People have been inventing new things from the very beginning.
So we're not talking about looking on a fine scale of something being created.
Solomon is not denying here the ability of man to be inventive.
But on the whole, there is nothing new. The same things happen day in and day out. When you see something strange, it's happened before. There is just a ceaselessness here, a repetition of futile activity that just goes on and on and on without end. And so he says, vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun?
Solomon is doing something here that is so effective that many people actually miss it.
Some people, in trying to find something very deep, have just missed out completely his attempt to get you to the point where you are so low, so far down, that he is able to drive home a point to you.
Isn't it how we often teach? To get people where they're so low that they're able to finally look up and look for the answer? It's what he's doing. Hopefully you're thinking this is just useless. If you're one of those who had this philosophy, you're probably saying, yeah, I might as well go for whatever there is, because like Solomon's saying, hey, there's nothing else. I might as well get what I can get out of it, because there is nothing else. It's futility.
And if Solomon is very skilled, and Solomon will come to a conclusion when we conclude this particular message that will give you some hope. Hopefully you are thinking that this is all futility, that there is nothing to be gained from it. Solomon searched these very things himself. In verse 12, he says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel and Jerusalem, and I applied my heart to seek and to search out by wisdom all that is done under heaven. It is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. He recognizes the rat race, so to speak. He recognizes the race on the treadmill, and he sets out to use his wisdom to find some meaning in it all. Where can I find meaning? Where can I find joy that really means something? And so he sets out to apply his wisdom to that problem. Surely if any sense can be made of it all, this man, this unique man in history, would be the one to do it. He had the means, he had the resources to look into the matter. And so what seems like a depressing assessment here by Solomon of our state in the world is going to be a clue that there is hope in all of this. Do you see the hope that Solomon has just given to us? At first it seems like senselessness and futility. When he says it is an unhappy business that God has given to the children of man to be busy with, you might look at that and think, boy, that's pretty depressing. That's a sorry state. It's a sorry task is another way to translate that. It's a sorry task that God has given to man to be busy with these things. It's an unhappy business. Do you see the glimmer of hope there? That this has been given to you by God. That all of this, what seems like chaos and senselessness, all of this that seems like it has no meaning whatsoever actually has been given to you by God. So here is the hope that God, who is divine and who is able to run things decently and orderly, perhaps there is some meaning here after all. If God is involved in giving this business to man, perhaps there's a clue here that gives us some hope.
So, of course, there is an assumption here on Solomon's part that you have at least some belief in divinity, that there is some belief in God. There's not an atheist necessarily in view here, and they are very few in actuality anyway. There is an assumption on Solomon's part that you at least have some kind of belief in God, that there is a God, because he simply states that it is an unhappy business or a sorry task that God has given to the children of man to be busy with. It's not random. It's not chance. We are not just animals acting out on our instincts here, but rather God has something to do with all of it because he has given us this business. There is a clue. I need to hold on to that. You need to latch on to that. But God has given you this business. And if you think it is a sorry state that you're in right now, living like a rat in a cage or someone on a treadmill going nowhere, then God is the one you need to look to for the meaning in all of that, for some kind of purpose there. It's not just random. I'll give you another hint here as to why things are the way they are. Look what he says when he talks about who this business has been given to in verse 13. It is an unhappy business or a sorry task that God has given to the children of man. In the Hebrew, there is the children of Adam. The word is Adam. Some have translated that and made it plural when Solomon did not intend there for there to be a plural word. It is a singular, the children of man or the children of Adam. It is deliberately not plural. And is there perhaps some reference to the fall of mankind in Adam? Perhaps all of this existence that we are experiencing now, perhaps all of this futility, this meaninglessness, this seeming senselessness, perhaps all of this is tied into man's sin against God. Perhaps it is tied in to Adam and his sin. I know it is unpopular, particularly if you're accustomed to watching television shows on public TV or in Discovery Channel or something like that. It's not very popular to talk about Adam as a real man, but he's just as real as Solomon was. And he is mentioned here, I believe, in person by Solomon when he talks about this business having been given to the children of man. Paul talks about this futility in the creation in Romans chapter 8, verse 20. Look that up when you have an opportunity. Romans chapter 8, verse 20. All of creation has been subject to futility, but in hope of a future day when those things will change. So here, as Solomon has come to the point where he's just dragged you down to the lowest that you can possibly be in thinking that there's any meaning to all of this, just when he's taking all of the joy out of your existence, he gives this bit of hope and will lead to a conclusion here that gives even more hope as it continues to drag you down at the same time. You can't do anything. You can't do anything to find meaning in all of this, is what he says here. Look at verse 14. I have seen everything that is done under the sun, and behold, all is vanity and a striving after wind. A striving after wind. You ever try to catch the wind? That's what it's like for you to go out on your own, apart from God, and try to find any meaning in it. It's like going out and trying to grab hold after the wind, to strive after the wind. It's futility. What is crooked cannot be made straight, and what is lacking cannot be counted. If it's crooked, you can't straighten it out. If you don't have it, you can't count it. You can't gain it. That's what it's like for humanity, apart from God making this clear and giving this as a gift. You cannot find that meaning. You cannot enjoy these things. So God has been brought into it by Solomon. God is brought in by Solomon. It's not something you can do on your own, he says. It's something that is beyond you. You don't have the ability to do it. So that is that rat race, so to speak. That is that treadmill that God has given to you. And if there's going to be any meaning, then we need to remember God is responsible for this, and we need to look to him for the answers. But look now at the futility of self-indulgence. This is where many of you will find yourselves, and many of you here today have found yourself in the past, in self-indulgence, a satisfying of the appetites. Solomon had it all in chapter 2, verse 1. He said, I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with pleasure. Enjoy yourself. For here is a test. Maybe it's in just living to satisfy the appetites. laughter
and good times. Don't we all enjoy those times when we're sitting around with loved ones or with friends, sitting around the table just able to enjoy good times, telling jokes, and it feels good. It lifts our hearts, it lifts our spirits to laugh together and to make fun together. There are good times. And yet he says at the conclusion of verse 1, behold, this also was vanity. It was futility. He looked for it in wine. He says, I said of laughter it is mad, and of pleasure what use is it? I searched with my heart how to cheer my body with wine, my heart still guiding me with wisdom all at the same time. How to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the children of man to do under heaven during the few days of their life. I made great works. I built houses and planted vineyards for myself. I made myself gardens and parks and planted in them all kinds of fruit trees. He made pools of water, forests of growing trees, male and female slaves that were born in his house that he bought for himself. There was nothing he denied himself, or nothing that his heart desired that he did not gain for himself. He gathered, he says in verse 8, for himself silver and gold, the treasure of kings and provinces. I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of men. Laughter in good times, it was useless. Wine wasn't where it was at. Pleasant places, if he couldn't go there, he made them for himself. He didn't have to go there. He created pleasant places with pools of water and forests. Servants for himself to meet his every need. Possessions, untold treasure, music, and yes, women. Women for himself. There was nothing that he denied himself. And yet, what does he say of it all? In verse 1, behold, this also was vanity. What use is it? What use is it? It's all to no avail. Perhaps you're sitting out there and listening to this and saying, this is what I'm living for. This is what society is telling me that I ought to be going for. These are all the things where I will find joy and happiness. What's better than good times with the family, spending quality time with friends, with laughter and with a little bit of wine, going on trips to faraway, pleasant places, to be able to enjoy possessions in this life, to have treasures stored up so that I can have security in life. Music. Music is pleasant. Music, everybody loves music. And of course there's sensuality with women. He talks about sex. That's what he means when he talks about I got singers, both men and women, and many concubines, the delight of the children of man. You know, he's talking about sexual relations with women. That's what many of us, many of you have lived for, have been led to believe is what this human existence is all about. He explored it. He did it. Nothing was withheld from him. He just let go. Just as you are told to do, let go and go for it. Whatever you can get. All to no avail, he says. There was no gain in it. There was no profit in it, except for temporary enjoyment. He said, other than that, it was just striving after wind. He says, I kept my heart, in verse 10, from no pleasure, for my heart found pleasure in all my toil. And this was my reward for all my toil. Temporary pleasure that would come at the moment, in the midst of those things that he would enjoy. And yet he was no closer to finding out any meaning in life. And if that's your goal, if these things are your goal, if that's what life is to you, it's fun and family and good times and there pretty much is nothing else, then what kind of a condition are you in? If there was nothing in it for Solomon, if he said it was useless, are you any better than he was? Look what he said in verse 12. The second part of verse 12. What can the man do who comes after the king? If he had all these things, if he had already been there, already done that, and found no use in it, what more can you do? Can you attain to the things that he had attained? Can you do the things that he did and have all of the things that he did? No way. And so, listen to him. And I think one of the saddest things I had ever heard was an opportunity that I had had to speak to some young people.
and talk to them about learning from those who have come before them.
To say, listen to your parents, particularly when they're speaking wisely, and they are telling you, you ought to avoid this and you ought to avoid that, you really shouldn't do this or you shouldn't do this,
because I did those very same things and it led to nothing but trouble.
Avoid these things.
When you hear your parents telling you, I've been there and I've done that, don't go that way yourself,
the wisest thing you can do is to listen to them, because they've already been there. They know, just like Solomon is telling you now.
And the saddest thing I ever heard was the response of one of those young people, which was basically this:
well, that was okay for you, but we need to find out for ourselves. You know, we need to find these things out for ourselves.
You know, it's okay, you know, you messed up and you did these things and it was not good for you, but
I totally disregard that, is what they were saying, these young people. We just disregard that. We need to find these things out for ourselves. Pathetic. And that is the condition of anyone who would listen to Solomon, who says, what can the man do who comes after the king?
You can't attain any more than he did. You can't do any more than he did. You can't get any more than he did and expect to find any meaning out of it, because he's telling you, it's not there. There's nothing there. It's emptiness. It's meaningless. And so there is futility and self-indulgence. Then he talks about the futility, thirdly, of living wisely. You may be one of those types of people who says, well, I'm not one of those materialistic young people who just seeks to get whatever I can get out of life. I'm seeking meaning in life by being a good person, by doing good to other people, you know, the golden rule, do unto others as you would have them do unto you. That's what I'm like. I live a moral life, and I think in the end that's going to mean something, particularly when I stand before God. He's going to know that, you know, I lived a pretty wise life, and that's what it takes. Well, would you be surprised to know that Solomon says there's no use in that either? There's no use in living wisely. Look at verse 12. He says, so I turned to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who comes after the king? Only what has already been done. Then I saw that there is more gain in wisdom than in folly, as there is more gain in light than in darkness. The wise person has his eyes in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. And yet, I perceive that the same event happens to all of them. Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity. For of the wise as of the fool there is no enduring remembrance, seeing that in the days to come all will have been long forgotten. How the wise dies just like the fool. So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving after wind. You think maybe the answer is here in living a moral life and living some kind of wise life? Well, he gives you this much, at least, that wisdom is at least better than folly. It's at least better in this life to live a wise life, because after all, it's like the difference between light and darkness. The wise can see things. They have the eyes in their heads. They're able to foresee difficulties and to plan for them. They're able to know a little bit about the world and what happens. At least that is better than being a fool who is just clueless about what is going on. But you know what, in the end, what difference does it really make? What difference? Because that fool is going to die just like I am, and I'm going to die just like he is. And he is, as I said last week, you know, when we talked about the animals, like roadkill. What difference does it make whether you live a wise life or not if you end up just like the fool? So in the end, it doesn't matter.
What difference does it make when the wise dies just like a fool? So I hated life, because what is done under the sun was grievous to me, for all is vanity and striving after wind. That's not where the answer is. There is futility in living even a wise life for its own sake. Now, that's also the futility of all human effort as he starts to wind down here and come to a conclusion. The futility of all his toil. In verse 18, I hated all my toil in which I toil under the sun, seeing that I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will be a master of all which I toiled and used my wisdom under the sun. This also is vanity.
Some people think it would be good to gather up their goods and leave them as an inheritance to their children. Now that would be a wise thing to do, to work real hard or to amass all of these goods. But what good is that in the end? He says, when I leave it to someone who didn't work for it, I leave all of this that I worked so hard for somebody who didn't work for it. And how do I know what they're going to do with it? They may go out and just blow it on racing cars and airplanes and all kinds of stuff that mean nothing. They may just go out and just blow it on having a good time. So what's the sense of that? I just hated life, he says. I hated all my toil because it was useless. It's vanity. And so the conclusion he comes to in verse 20 is, I turned about and gave my heart up to despair over all the toil of my labors under the sun, because sometimes a person who has toiled with wisdom and knowledge and skill must leave everything to be enjoyed by someone who did not toil for it. In the end, you're leaving it all behind anyway. It all gets left behind in the end when you're dead and they bury you in the ground. Everything you gained, everything that you worked so hard for is left to somebody else to enjoy. So what is the use? What is the use? Pessimistic? Yeah, it sounds that way. Is there any use in any of this working in this rat race of an existence that we have, this treadmill of an existence? Is there any use in it? Not for a majority of people in this day and in this age. But as he closes here, in this particular section, let's come to the hope that he leaves you with. Looking at chapter 2, verse 24 and on through 26. There is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. This also I saw is from the hand of God. For apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting. Only to give to one who pleases God. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. He's come to the conclusion. And it is the argument that we started with, that as hard as you may try to find true happiness and meaning in this life, it is nothing but an exercise in futility, because true happiness and joy and meaning come as gifts from God. Look at verse 24. There's an interesting thing that takes place here. Most translations, I think, most English translations say there is nothing better for a person than that he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. Interestingly enough, Kaiser brings out an issue here concerning the language, and saying that there are other verses that are similar to this in the book of Ecclesiastes that read like this, where the word better is there. There is nothing better for a person than he should eat and drink and find enjoyment in his toil. But that word is not found in this particular verse, in verse 24. And so, most English translations he has found fault with, and I thought it was interesting that if that word is not there, that he is on to something. Not that it changes the meaning of the verse radically, but it clarifies it. If you translate, as he suggests in verse 24, there is not a good in man that he should enjoy these things. In other words, there is no ability in man. He does not have the ability to enjoy these things. And he says furthermore, this also I saw is from the hand of God. That's the whole argument he's been making from the very beginning. That it is not up to you. You do not have the ability to enjoy these things apart from it being given to you by God. There is not a good in man that he should enjoy these things. Not that there is nothing better for a person than that he should enjoy these things, but rather man does not have the ability. Rather it is, they are gifts from God. And a relationship, Solomon says, with him is necessary. Because he says in verse 25, for apart from him, who can eat or who can have enjoyment? There is the answer, or part of the answer that we've been looking at from the very beginning. But God has something to do with all of this. And I hate to shake you up and to make you start feeling a little queasy here or a little bit nervous, because you have to now start thinking about your existence and God and how God fits in with you and all of your belief systems. This may be shaking you up, but it is intimately tied in with your existence. He said earlier that God has given you this business. But God is intimately involved, that it is not just chance. And now he is saying that apart from him, you're not going to get the answers. You're not going to enjoy anything or find any meaning in life apart from Him. This relationship with Him is necessary. That's what he's been arguing for the first chapter and throughout the second chapter as well. And perhaps you would object. Perhaps there are some out there who would say, but wait a minute. I enjoy these things when I'm out there in a fine restaurant with a steak and lobster dinner. I enjoy that every bit as much as you do. When I enjoy the good things that are in life, I'm enjoying them just like you are. And yet I would say there is a distinction. There is a distinction between enjoying something that you have toiled for, that you have paid money for, and that ultimately is a reward to you, is a wage to you. There is a difference between enjoying something like that and enjoying something that has been given to you as a gift. There's a big difference. When you enjoy that steak and lobster dinner, it's with the understanding that you earned it, that you deserve this because you worked hard for the money that came that allowed you to buy it. And when you enjoy all of the things in life like that, they are like wages to you. They're not a gift. And so you don't enjoy them like the person who knows the God who has given these things to him as a gift. When you find something in the street and you take it home and you don't know who the owner is, so it becomes your possession, you enjoy it. But do you enjoy it as much as if someone who loved you gave it to you as a gift? You don't. When somebody gives it to you as a gift, you not only enjoy the thing itself, but part of the enjoyment comes from enjoying the one who gave it to you. And that is the distinction. So there are some who would sit out there and say, oh, I enjoy the fine things in life, but you enjoy them as payments. You enjoy them as things you have earned for yourself. The one who knows God not only gets the enjoyment, the pleasure out of eating, the pleasure out of a spouse who loves them, the pleasure out of many of the things that God has given as a gift, he not only enjoys those things with a clear conscience, but he is at the very same time enjoying his God. And that is the distinction that Solomon is making here. Apart from him and a relationship with him and knowing him, you can't truly enjoy these things. Because someone who has this relationship with God that Solomon is speaking about can enjoy little or a lot. If he has a lot, he thanks his God for giving him far more than he could ever deserve as a gift. And he thanks God for it. If God has given him a little, guess what? He still thanks his God for giving him far more than he deserves, for giving him something that he shouldn't have in the first place. And yet you may be, at the very same time you're enjoying that steak and lobster dinner, being complaining about the cost of it, how much it's going to cost you, how much you're going to have to pay for it. And yet the one who has this relationship with God that Solomon speaks about enjoys his God, brings glory to his God, gives his God glory, and enjoys him in the very act of enjoying these things that God has given. He sees these things as gifts. And so when someone gives you something as a gift, it is free. A gift is freely given. It's not earned. And so you see that as an instance of love being bestowed upon you, and you love that person in return for giving you that gift. And that's the kind of enjoyment, I think, that Solomon is talking about here. You are able, as one who has this kind of a relationship, to enjoy these things fully and completely, knowing that they are given to you as a gift from God, and you're content, you're satisfied with what he has given you, whether it be a lot or whether it be little. And so that is the distinction. I would close here also in saying that there is a distinction between people that Solomon makes here as well. Who are these ones that enjoy their God this way? He says in verse 6, 26 of chapter 2, "For to the one who pleases him, God has given wisdom and knowledge and joy. But to the sinner, he has given the business of gathering and collecting, only to give to one who pleases God." That's futility. Notice the distinction he makes between people here. Are you one of those who is under the impression that God loves everyone equally, and that there is no distinction with God? It's not what Solomon says. He says there is a distinction between people. There are those who please him, or elsewhere he will say those who fear him, and then there are those who are sinners. So we're not all sinners, are we? There are some who are sinners and there are those who please Him. That is the distinction. Those who fear Him, that's not the idea of someone cowering in fear. That is not the idea even of someone in reverential awe. That is the idea of someone who believes God so much so that he is affected in his daily walk, that he behaves in a certain manner according to what God has commanded.
He lives according to the commandments of God. That's what it means in biblical language to fear Him.
It's to believe Him and to do what He says. That is the distinction made from the sinner. The sinner is one who does not obey God's commands.
And so you can see what the definition there is of one who pleases Him.
It's not this idea that God is paying you back. It's not someone out there who is living a really good life as best he can, and God is pleased by that and gives him all these good things as a reward. That's not the idea at all.
But that is matter for another lesson. Note, at least here, the distinction between people.
That God gives these things to those who please Him. They are the ones who are found obeying Him.
And so let me close then with some words. I found a profitable quote from Kaiser. I'll close with his words when he says, "The purpose of life cannot be found in any one of the good things found in the world. All the things that we call the goods of life, health, riches, possessions, position, sensual pleasure, honors, and prestige, all of these things slip through man's hands unless they are received as a gift from God, and until God gives man the ability to enjoy them and obtain satisfaction from them. God gives that ability to those who begin by fearing," that is, believing Him. So as we conclude here, I hope that I've made it plain that apart from any relationship with God, apart from Him giving you these gifts, you do not have the ability.
You will be on a rat race, or in a rat race, on a treadmill, the rat in the cage on the little wheel,
going round and round and round with a meaningless existence.
If you do not recognize that, number one, God has given you this business, and number two, to enjoy these things is impossible for you to attain.
The enjoyment, the meaning of these things is impossible for you to attain apart from knowing the God who gives them to you as a gift. Next week we will delve a little more deeply into the sovereignty of God, God's plan in all of this. I hope that you would continue on reading, if you haven't done that already. Read the book of Ecclesiastes. Read it with those kinds of eyes or that kind of a mindset that we have just had in this hour. Rather than just seeing this as a pessimistic old man with no hope in life, look at it as someone who knew his God intimately, who knew what it was to be in the position of so many people today who are going after just all they can get in this world because they don't see anything else after that.
He knew what it was like to be in that position because he just described it to you.
He just read for you, or we just read your very life in many cases in the words of Solomon. He was there. And yet he gave hope in pointing out that God gives these things and he can be known. And therefore there is hope to us. And next week we'll see more of that. Now let's close in prayer. Father, as we would close this hour, this time of study, it is first and foremost with thanksgiving. For you have given to us, in the words of Scripture, things that we need to hear, things that we need to know, plainly written, Father, without any code necessary to decipher these things. Lord, there is no hidden meaning in any of these things, Lord, but what you would have us to know is plainly on these pages and preserved for us. And as we have read from the book of Ecclesiastes today, we thank you, Lord, for the words of Solomon, and for the argument that he has made that all of our toils, all of our efforts, Lord, all of our gathering up of goods is just an exercise in futility, apart from having a relationship with the God who gives these things, Lord, to his people. Thank you for these truths, Lord. Drive them deeply into our hearts. Prepare us for the next time, Lord, when we can continue in the study. We pray in Christ's name. Amen.